Welcome to Micro College. This is Jacob Hunt. I'm the executive director of Thoreau College. We are a micro college located in Viroqua, Wisconsin. We're recording this in January of 2026. If you're listening to this, check us out on the internet, thoreaucollege.org. We're accepting applications for several programs throughout this year, our Metamorphosis Gap Semester, our Driftless Field School Summer Program, as well as our fellowship and internship and residency programs. This week on the podcast, I'm thrilled to interview, to welcome here to Viroqua, to the studio here in Viroqua, one of the most important people in my biography, one of my teachers and mentors and heroes. Today we are welcoming L. Jackson Newell, formerly president of Deep Springs College. Welcome, Jack.
Jacob, so glad to be here.
Yeah. Jack, I met Jack when I was an 18-year-old headed out here from Viroqua after the experience of being involved with starting a high school here as a teenager and landing in the amazing Deep Springs Valley, where Jack was the president. Jack Newell was himself a student of Deep Springs back in the 1950s. He then went on to a career in higher education. Ultimately, he was the dean of liberal education at the University of Utah. But along the way, he also he has had a really historic role in the history of Deep Springs College. He served as a trustee for many years and as the president during the time before and after and during when I was a student, at a time of great transition and renewal and rejuvenation of Deep Springs. This key micro college started in 1917. That is part of the inspiration for what we do at Thoreau College. And subsequently, Jack has literally written the book on Deep Springs College and on its founder, L.L. Nunn, recently just republished under a new title called The Saga of Lucien L. Nunn and Deep Springs College. And if you're curious about Deep Springs and about this history, this is an essential text. So thank you so much for being with us here, Jack.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jacob.
So here on the Micro College podcast, we would like to ground our conversations in people's lives and their biographies. And I'd like to ask you the same question that I ask to all the guests here, which is, where were you 18 to 21 years old? And what were the big impacts and the big influences in your life in that period that you, as you think of it now?
Good. Well, when I was 17 years old, I was at the young end of the cycle of my class, so I graduated from high school in the middle of my 17th year. I had been strongly influenced by a number of things, a family that greatly valued education, that greatly valued liberal education, the opening of minds, the embracing of a broader world, and those were very powerful elements of my life, as were experiences in the out-of-doors. My family, during the Depression, acquired a property for $600 off the grid in Georgian Bay, Ontario. And so the most wonderful elements of my childhood were going up there for a month during the summer. It was on an isolated, tiny little island. So we canoed, we swam, we fished. And we had almost no contact with the outside world. Had to take everything with us for the month. So that continues to live with me, and that property is still in the family.
And I've had the pleasure of visiting that place, and it is a magical, magical spot in the Georgian Bay in Lake Huron. Amazing.
It is. It is. So that had quite an impression on me in terms of my relationship to the natural world, as did road trips during my childhood. When we went to Colorado, where my parents had the remnants of a ranch that my grandfather thrived on and continued to work. But those were also in the Rockies, a very wonderful and stimulating part of my childhood. And finally, I would say, leading up to my graduation from high school, between my junior and senior year, just after getting our driver's licenses, my best buddy and I dreamed up the idea of touring the West from our home in near Dayton, Ohio. And when we sprung this on my parents, their reaction was, "Oh, that's great. How are you going to earn the money?" I don't think Bill and I had thought about that yet. To make the story short, however, we earned the money collecting scrap iron in farms in the vicinity of our home and working as janitors at a bank, and ended up spending 11 weeks driving all over the West, camping every mile of the way, and learning a great deal about independence. But on that trip, we went through Deep Springs Valley, because I had heard of Deep Springs through a family friend who went there. And that so inspired my imagination that I went back and studied extra hard to qualify for admission to Deep Springs during my senior year. So I was predisposed to experiences in nature, and I was predisposed to liberal education. And what a match when I discovered Deep Springs and was fortunate enough to be admitted. So another interesting story related to that is that when I was aspiring to apply to college, mm-hmm. I had no idea whether I would get into Deep Springs or not. So I had a primary plan, which was to study geology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Uh-huh.
The Alcan Highway was relatively new at that time, so I hatched a scheme of buying a car with my dad's help, going to Detroit to pick it up. Then the idea was drive it up the Alcan Highway, sell it at such a profit that it would cover the tuition for my first year. So I had my room reserved. That plan was go when I got a letter in the mail from C.N. Whitman at Deep Springs saying, "You've been admitted." So my whole life course just flipped.
Yeah.
The opening of an envelope there. There was no doubt in my mind where I was going to go. So Deep Springs itself had a profound effect on me.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, it was a three-year program. We didn't have classes in the summer. So combined with the farm and ranch work, it took 3 years to get 2 years credit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a chunk of my experience again. And I can't ever remember being as excited as I was climbing into the upper bunk of my bed in the dorm room and just anticipating what was ahead. And what was ahead matched the anticipation that night. And I never got Deep Springs out of my system in a way. So I went on from there. Incidentally, I, through a nice quirk of chance, ended up working for the U.S. Forest Service during my college summers. And one of those experiences was particularly apropos, I think, particularly when I think about our common interest here of education. I had worked several summers as a smoke chaser, firefighter,
mm-hmm.
and then at Crater Lake in the summer of 1960, I was hired as the fire crew chief. And so at the age of 21, I had six other guys who were a year or two younger than me, and we constituted the crew. I went at the request of the chief ranger a week early, and he put me through the paces, finding how qualified I was and how physically fit I was. He really put the screws to me. And then the crew arrived, and my job was to break them in and to train them. Some of them had not really fought fires before that time. And then, after we had gotten all the equipment in order and I'd mastered the maps of the park and we knew how to get to every square inch of Crater Lake National Park should a fire break out in any of those places, we wondered what was next. It was a very wet and snowy spring, and so the area where you'd expect forest fires, much of it was still covered by snow.
Mm-hmm.
So the chief ranger invited me in to his office on July 1 and said, he asked me a number of questions about our preparation, seemed satisfied. And then he said, have you ever done any carpentry work? And I said, oh, yeah. He said, like what? And I said, well, I built a bench that we have in front of the fireplace at home. And He said, "No, I've did you ever build a house or a barn or something?" I said, "Well, no, I certainly haven't." He said, "Well, do you think you could?" Now he's asking a 21-year-old kid, "Do you think you could?" And I thought I could.
Of course, so, yeah.
So he said, "Well, I'll tell you what I've got in mind." For a number of years, he'd been the chief ranger for 15 years. I've wanted a boathouse on Wizard Island where we can store the rescue boat that we just drag up on shore every fall, and then it gets beaten by the winter. And I'd like a boathouse on Wizard Island. So I'll collapse the story for now, but to say he gave me the rest of the summer, a great deal of freedom, and instructions for the dimensions of this boathouse, and almost nothing more. And he said, "You've got the crew for the rest of the summer. Build that boathouse."
Wow.
And then, crucially, he said, "What day do you leave?" The end of the summer. And I said, "I think it's September 6th. And he said, "Good, I'll be down on the 5th. But don't expect to see me around there until then." So he dumped the whole job in my lap. You've never seen seven guys work so hard in your life. We were trusted. He believed in us. He supported us. We were not going to let him down. And that, the lesson from that is so close to the philosophy of Deep Springs.
Yeah.
That I would have to say it shaped, it topped off an education that had shaped my life.
Yeah. That's a great story. And I think it's, and also such a dramatic setting, right?
Oh, yes.
There's so many dramatic settings, right? In, you know, Deep Springs and the West. And the podcast here, we've, you know, many of our conversations have been directed towards the East, towards Europe, towards you know, New England. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the history of higher education is in that, in those regions. But something so distinctive about Deep Springs and about L.L. Nunn and about everyone who's been touched by Deep Springs is the drama of the American West. And I think part of it also is this kind of the spirit that is embodied in this story of, yeah, you entrust people with big projects and let them go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you believe they can do it. Yeah.
Has a big impact. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe, you know, it's been a couple of years since we've spoken with someone here on the podcast, and never with anyone with your pedigree and be able to talk about it. Last time we had a couple of students and they were great and talking about the students' experience. But I'd love, you know, for you, if you could set the scene for us, first of all, physically. Can you describe the setting of Deep Springs?
Deep Springs is in an isolated valley, which is about the size of Manhattan Island, something like 10 miles wide and averages perhaps 3 miles, or 10 miles long and perhaps 3 miles wide. And this basin is poised just east of the Sierra Nevada Range. So from Deep Springs Valley, you look across Westgard Pass, and there are 14,000-foot peaks in your view. It is a stunning place, and yet the basin itself is a classic Mojave Desert, high and dry sagebrush with solitude galore. And L.L. Nunn, the founder of Deep Springs, talked about the voice of the desert,
mm-hmm.
That the solitude, the chance to wander unimpeded creates a leavening of the soul that changes the way a person can see the world and our place in the universe. So that valley is a place that was ideally chosen, partly by serendipity and partly by intent, as Nunn was trying to figure out where to plant his educational experiment called Deep Springs College.
Yeah.
Named for the valley.
Anyone who's been to Deep Springs, even as a visitor, will remember the first time they enter the valley from one of the passes on both ends. It's a vast expanse with the green oasis in the middle of it. I remember the first time I entered the valley. It was a snowstorm, and which is, you know, somewhat rare in the snow on the valley bottom. And it was so to wake up the morning after arriving, the smell of sagebrush, and you know, there's like, that's one of those moments that comes back to me often in the right kind of weather,
again,
whether I'm there or not. Yeah.
Yeah.
it's one of those, iconic views, and just and that sets the setting for dramatic changes in the inner life of the student, right?
Right. And in researching my book on Deep Springs all the way back to Herb Reich, who was in the first class in 1917, you have tales of the first impression of dropping into the valley.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, L.L. Nunn, Lucien L. Nunn, another Ohioan like you. What can you tell us about him? What is his story, and how did he end up to do this this unusual thing?
Yeah. L.L. Nunn was born in northern Ohio. He had an eye defect, which made it somewhat difficult for him to read. He was born in 1853, I think, as I recall. And he was intellectually curious and adventurous. And he would skim books from a relatively early age and then engage people in conversation about it. And as he got older and more mobile, he would read books, and then he would find a way to go visit the author and engage them directly in a conversation, or to visit a college class that was perhaps studying what he had just been reading about. And so he developed a technique of absorbing from other people.
Uh-huh.
By getting the kernel of the idea and then exploring its implications, its meaning, and its potential. So that was his method of learning. He was 5'2", a tiny fellow, very intense, with eyes that people remarked again and again throughout his life were just piercing and alive. But he spent a year and a half on the campus of Oberlin when a couple of older brothers went to school there, and he just tagged along. And the president of Oberlin at the time was an anti-slavery evangelist and dedicated to spreading the word the best he could. And Nunn, with the personality that I've mentioned already, Grandison Finney just took Nunn under his wing, and he had him reading volumes of the Edinburgh Review and serious books, and he would just spend leisure time visiting with Nunn and stimulating him, and obviously saw something of high potential there. Then Nunn visited Europe a couple of times with the support of older sisters who thought that that would be an important part of his education, but his whole family was worried about him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was kind of not taking hold, not supporting himself, but this live wire that was just engaged in so many things. So it wasn't until he was 27 that he did much more than just cast about, exploring ideas, talking with people. He was a gadfly. And then suddenly he was inspired by Russell and Teddy Roosevelt and others to go west and test his mettle, which he did, and ended up in Leadville. Found a friend there, and they founded a restaurant, which then became pretty hot in terms of a lot of the lawless activity that was going on in Leadville.
Leadville, Colorado, this is the Wild West, right?
At its wildest. Wild. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Well put. So ended up drifting down to Durango. That didn't work out very well. Telluride, Colorado was just opening as a mining area at the time, called To Hell You Ride, or Telluride. And so he and his buddy went over there and began building windows for miners' cabins in the winter, which then they get installed and come spring, and went to work for someone who was wanted him to help manage the mine, and one of many mines in that area. That led, however, to Nunn deciding that why should he be managing somebody else's mine? He'd like to do his own. So he established a mine of his own. Quickly made that a success, ended up founding an alternate newspaper for Telluride, founding the bank, which is currently being celebrated for its architecture that he was behind. Uh-huh. Things were booming. And then there was a labor strike about late 1880s. And more importantly, and this is partly behind the labor strike, by the way, they had burned almost all the wood off the hillsides to run the steam engines into stamp mills to reduce the ore. And so the mines were going suddenly bankrupt, 1889, and locals were wringing their hands and wondering what to do, and none had an idea. Again, this intellectual curiosity had been following Nikola Tesla's development of alternating current and the potential that it had for being able to transmit over much greater distances. So Nunn boarded a train, went to Pittsburgh, found George Westinghouse, which I think he had arranged the meeting in advance, and said, look, Tesla's got the theory. You're developing the manufacturing capability. I can build the dam, put in the penstocks, run the wires to my mine, if you'll make a 100-horsepower generator matched by a 100-horsepower motor. And let's see if we can make this work. Well, Westinghouse was inspired by this. So he said, let's go to my board and present this. Well, they did, and the board turned him down. They thought this tiny little guy from Colorado, what in the world could he do? And so when Dunn and George Westinghouse left the meeting, Westinghouse says, they're an embarrassment to me. This is ridiculous. I will go in with you personally, put my own money into this project. But he did. So in June 1890, Nunn had everything ready to go. They had installed the equipment from Westinghouse, and they had a big knife switch, which Nunn himself threw, and the charge of the electricity bolted across the gap in the knife switch as it was closing, scared the dickens out of everybody. But within moments, a telegraph teletype message came down from the mine, and the motor up there had leapt into action. The experiment worked.
Yeah.
So from that point, Nunn was much in demand by other miners originally just in that immediate area, saying, hey, could you build one of those for me? And this led to his giving up his interest in mines. The whole new excitement now was what you could do with hydroelectric power, alternating current. So that opened a phase of his career where he had the development of the world's leading technology in hydropower, and he built power plants from Canada to central Mexico and ultimately the huge Ontario power works at Niagara Falls.
Yeah. And this is like, you know, NVIDIA, or it's like this is the cutting edge, like, technology of the age, really. And it's also in all these remote places up in the mountains.
That's exactly right. Yes. So as he developed all these power plants in those remote places, and by the way, he had discovered that his original assumption that he could just take men who worked for him in his mines and transfer them over to run these power plants. It didn't work that way. Again, modern analogy, old people don't adapt to computers when they were first coming out, especially. Always needed to turn to a grandchild to tell them how to do this, right, or that. So the same thing was happening then. So his miners didn't end up being effective. So he went after students coming out of high school that were bright, maybe didn't have a chance to go to college, and he would hire them on a 3-year program at an educational center that he established at the Olmsted plant near Provo, Utah, which is still there. It's not operating as a school, but you can still see how and where it was. The idea was to take these students, have them work full-time the first year as interns, and if they showed promise, the second year, he said, okay, you're going to be half-time student and half-time labor. And if they did well that year as students, third year, you're a full-time student. And at the end of that third year, if he still believed in you, then he said, I'll pay your tuition to study originally electricity and hydropower in Ohio State and Cornell, were the places to go at that time. So at one point he had over 400 students whose tuition he was paying. And then he ran into a huge conflict with his co-investor. He always made sure he was the primary stakeholder, but he wanted other people with him so he could multiply the effect of his money. But James Campbell from St. Louis was his secondary investor in all the Telluride Power Company business, and he was wanting to milk more money out of the company, mm-hmm. and didn't like what he called the diversion of their money into these educational projects. And then said, look, they're essential to us having people run our power plants. It's actually an efficiency. Well, Campbell didn't buy that, and so he sued Nunn for maladministration.
Mm-hmm.
And this ended up going to the federal court in Colorado, which inspired Nunn, thinking that he might well lose this battle, to found the Telluride Association at Ithaca, at Cornell in Ithaca, New York, with the idea of turning it over to the students, therefore protecting, no longer being an owner,
right.
It protected those funds from losing the suit. Well, it ended up in 1912, he won the suit, and he immediately turned to Campbell in a total surprise to Campbell and said, okay, I won, buy me out.
Yeah, because he was now interested in education.
That's right.
Right.
So he knew what he wanted to do. So at that point, L. L. Nunn decided that he needed to study education with the same enthusiasm and exhaustive effort that he had gotten into hydropower. And so he took 3 years of his life, which were 1913 through 16, studying and going to visit people like John Dewey,
mm-hmm.
Alexander Micheljohn, right here in Wisconsin. Actually, he wasn't here yet when he founded the Basic College at the University of Wisconsin. But definitely, he was a national figure, and he was one that Nunn connected with.
Again, seeking out the cutting edge, whoever is thinking the best and the brightest at that time, and going in, like, encountering them and talking to them directly, like with Westinghouse.
That's exactly right, yeah. And no compunction whatever about going to see the best.
Yeah.
He didn't apologize or think, oh, no, not me. I'm just a guy out west developing power. He always had this instinctive confidence that he could go talk with anyone and mm-hmm. learn from them.
It's a fascinating thing that I think that is, Deep Springers are a very diverse group of people. There's academics, there's business people, there's politicians, there's artists. But one thing that you see in a lot of Deep Springers is that quality. There's a confidence and, let's try it out and let's go to talk to someone. And that seems to be one of the products of the Nunnian education.
You nailed it, yes. And I see that in you, Jacob.
Yeah, I feel it. I think it's certainly one of the things I resonated with there, because I did get some of that out of my high school experience too.
Yeah. Yeah, it preceded Deep Springs in your case
well. To have a group of people mm-hmm. who have that confidence is powerful, just atmosphere to be around.
No doubt about it.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Telluride Association was the first, was an important founding, still existing today. I should mention we're speaking here on the occasion of a summit of Nunnian institutions here in Viroqua. We're really proud to be hosting at Thoreau College this weekend in the middle of January. It'll include representatives of Deep Springs, as well as Telluride, the older siblings in this movement, as well as Thoreau College and several other newer foundings out of this impulse. Telluride is founded in 1911.
It was, yes.
And then Deep Springs in 1917.
Right.
Can you trace the evolution or what's the relationship between Telluride and Deep Springs in that initial kind of constellation?
Sure. Telluride is physically akin to a fraternity or sorority house on the very edge of the campus at Cornell. But the idea is completely different, and that is this is to be a self-governing group of students, one of whose responsibilities is to orchestrate the small fortune that Nunn gave them and entrusted to them to keep this educational dream alive. And the educational dream, I think we should say, had to do with developing a can-do attitude, the kind of quality that you just mentioned in our conversation now, and that would inspire an interest in democracy. That mm-hmm. is, that you trust people, you give them responsibility, and you expect them to act in the common interest, in the public interest. So these ideas were very strong in his mind, and now we're talking about a period when the U.S. is in World War I. There is great public concern over what's happening to the democracies. Could democracy survive in the world? And Nunn was saying, yes, I believe in it, and my educational project is going to give students so much responsibility, and so much is going to be entrusted to them that they will naturally come out of this experience believing that it can be practiced as a nation, as a culture, or even as a local community.
Yeah. Yeah, it's striking in the podcast and you know, as we've been interviewing people, this is a widespread feeling in this time period here and abroad. The Danish folk high schools, which we've explored quite a bit, have a very similar impulse, both in the middle of the 19th century when they first were started, but also in this period, World War I and thereafter. There's a sense of democratization and a lot of concern of whether that will work out. Are people ready for it? And is the world ready for it, for this broad expansion of the franchise? And this is the time when women start to be able to vote. There's an expansion of in different countries, people get the right to vote for the first time at all. And all of these things are, there's a thought that there's the educational system needs to adjust to this reality.
Yeah. Another phase of Jefferson's ideal that if you're going to expand the right to vote, to more males at that time, but in the Westering movement in American history, then you had to expand education,
mm-hmm.
because you can't practice democracy unless people know and are able to converse about the issues and think beyond their own self-interest about what this means for my community, for my territory, for my state, etc.
Yeah. So we can see both Telluride and Deep Springs, participatory governance of various forms is core to Nunn's ideal, and giving of real responsibility over real things, whether it's big pools of money, in the case of Telluride, or buildings and machines and real important kind of practical decisions, in the case of Deep Springs. In the case of Deep Springs, which is initially is younger students, 3-year programs you mentioned. What are the key elements of Nunn's vision, initial vision for Deep Springs, and how has that evolved over time, over the last over 100 years or so?
Big question.
Yeah.
we'll start at the beginning.
Yeah.
I think Nunn believed that strongly that the soul of a person or character, as was the word most often used in those days, was something that was essential to be built if you were going to have people who could function in a democratic society or help to lead a democratic society. And this, he believed, could only be built through what he had been observing in these the education of these students in the power plant, starting with technical education. Still, he was watching and he was saying, these guys are learning stuff that is quite unusual. Because like during that second year that I described, they're working half-time, they're studying half-time, and they're seeing the connections. Then they go on to their third year at that school at the Provo plant, and they're studying full-time, but this is all infused by the direct experience, frustrations, successes that they had working a power plant, often in remote places. So responsibility, he came to believe, was a great educating force. So he wanted students to be given real things to work on, as you just said, and not play projects,
right,
but things that actually have to be done. And then trust, the ability to, first, to choose them wisely, which he winnowed out the ones who he didn't think were so good in that 3-year project of work the first year, half the next, and so forth. So by the time he was supporting them for study at Ohio State or Cornell, he was pretty sure he'd chosen students who had the potential to succeed and might grow up to be something like him, I would have to say, is what he had in mind. Anyway, so you have real work that you want to be at the base of this, high stakes, I think even dangerous elements, which are always present at in education that involves getting your hands dirty,
mm-hmm.
Being students having the experience of being trusted with the work, not supervised immediately, and essential to that, learning of your success, not by a superior saying, "Oh, good, nicely done," and patting you on the head,
mm-hmm.
but instead, "Oh, that fence I built is working. The cattle are not getting into the hay."
It is self-evident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So natural consequences is what I like to think of that as being.
Yeah.
So it's so much more effective to learn by discovering yourself that you screwed up than it is by someone telling you that you screwed up.
Yeah.
That's a totally different psychology.
I really, as a teacher of high school and now, college-age students, like, there's such a hunger in many students for that type of feedback from the world.
Yeah.
Right? There's a real sensitivity to fakery and artifice in an educational program. And,
that's
and
right.
it's hard to design, really, honestly. Like, a farm or, an enterprise of some kind that has real consequences is pretty much the only way to do it.
Yeah.
And it's, so that the complication of, the Deep Springers, we had Deep Springs students who are here for the conference, and we were talking about efficiency.
Yes.
Right? What is efficient? And this is not efficient, right? It is, but it is necessary, right?
That's right. Quite inefficient, in fact.
Right.
Because you build failure into the educational experience.
Right.
So failure is going to mean lost opportunity, lost tools, lost money in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So you have, the L.L. Nunn's life is striking, especially in comparison to many of the other founding type figures that we've been exploring here. He didn't write a whole bunch of books, right? He doesn't, he's got influences. Certainly John Dewey is an important one. And, there's some other...
Mickle John,
right? And those are his contemporaries, mm-hmm. Who are thinking about education. But really, like, he's not part of a philosophical kind of a lineage or anything like
right.
that. He's a man of action, of experience, and these developments coming out of they're experimental and iterative, and they lead to what we come to know as Nunnian education.
Exactly.
Now.
Yes.
Did he have a conception of what the academic component of Deep Springs might include?
Well, he even though it was informal, he studied philosophy intensely. So. And he exposed through visiting classes, not being enrolled as a student,
mm-hmm.
Implied in what I've said, but not explicit. He never earned a college degree, but he earned far more of an education that most people with degrees would ever dream of, because this was his instinct. He was curious. He wanted to know mm-hmm. these things. So out of this came how would I say what I'm trying to say here? Out of this came an awareness that the way we do things is not necessarily the way things might be done best.
Mm-hmm.
And so not coming out of the educational system, graduate programs, a PhD or whatever, but coming out of a practical, I've got to make these things work. This ranch has got to make a profit as best we can, even though its purpose here is educational experience. All of this meant that he was always looking for new ways to do things,
mm-hmm.
And not constrained all that much by traditional practices.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe to go back also to where we started, the setting here, we began by describing this dramatic and also, very importantly, very isolated setting, right? To get to Deep Springs, it's quite an ordeal even today, much less in an era, when you have it's horses or it's early kind of very early motor vehicles.
Yeah.
It's a place that is intentionally hard to get to and hard to leave. And also in this spectacular kind of wilderness of the desert.
True.
And so what was the idea with that? Why there?
Well, he felt that it was important for students to concentrate on the community that they're in. And that if Deep Springs were founded close to a town, and he tried a brief experiment in Virginia along those lines, students would become involved in local social events. And in his view at that time, students would become involved in dating and romance. And he thought all of this, that can come later.
Yep.
But for now, concentrate on the community where you are. So isolation was important, as it is at Deep Springs, for two reasons. And one is that it removes you from a lot of the ordinary concerns of teenagers. But the second thing is the voice of the desert that I mentioned earlier. The idea that in a remote place with solitude, you would have a chance to reflect and to think and just stand back in awe at the natural world. And he found in that enormous power and enormous potential. And I do too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, the desert. I mean, he, in his writings to the students, he talks about, you know, the classic kind of prophet in the wilderness, John the Baptist, and Jesus in the desert, and
Moses.
Yeah. And, you know, this is, there's, that's an environment which, you know, you have profound experiences in.
That's right. Yeah.
And certainly that landscape is one.
I want to go back to something here that you mentioned, and that is he didn't write books, but I want to say that he was enormously articulate.
Yeah.
He had a gift for being able to express himself, to use words that stick in your mind.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the endurance of his effect in education, his effect on you and his effect on me and others like us, is the fact that he said things so damn well that we remember them.
Yeah. So one of those phrases is, you know, the moral order of the universe.
Yes. Right.
So he says that the purpose of Deep Springs is for the students to take an oath of allegiance to the moral order of the universe. And Deep Springs has not been affiliated with the church or a particular religious stream, but L.L. Nunn is also explicit that this is a theistic institution.
True.
And so what could you say about L.L. Nunn's sort of spiritual or religious attitudes and how that plays out in what the Nunnian education looks like?
Yeah, like a lot of people, and it was interesting to me as I wrote his biography how much he wandered around and how typical I think that is. So as a young seeker, when he was writing his first expressions about the moral order of the universe, the MOU, as we always kidded about it at Deep Springs, he was very much a free thinker, although I think a theist would capture him, or a deist, as Jefferson was. I think he found inspiration, great moral lessons in Christian scriptures, for example, without taking much beyond that, the supernatural, seriously at all. And then later in his life, he became, in the middle of his life, more interested in traditional religion. He identified himself at that time as being an Episcopal. Mm-hmm. And the Episcopal Book of Common Prayer was always on the bookshelves at Deep Springs, so that as we used to do in the first probably half of Deep Springs' existence, church services, we gathered and had our own church services as a bunch of students. And we'd take turn preaching, quote unquote, just depending on our backgrounds. But it was something that Nunn encouraged, although he had no partisan interests in any church or, for that matter, in Christianity. So he really embraced people coming from diverse backgrounds throughout his life, which was distinctive for somebody born in the 1850s and flourishing and founding a college in the early 20th century.
Yeah, something, you know, you know, we're here, we've named our project here Thoreau College, so we're making, reciting the American Transcendentalists. I remember fondly reading Emerson with you when I was a student at Deep Springs, Emerson's American Scholar,
yes.
And you know, some of the classic statements about education. And I mean, Emerson is a huge figure during, you know, Nunn's early lifetime in American culture, and I'm wondering to what degree Emerson or the other Transcendentalists were part of his influence.
It seems to me indirectly, profoundly, but directly, he did not show any particular interest in Thoreau or mm-hmm. in Emerson, Whitman and others, mm-hmm. Emily Dickinson. But I think the spirit of that era and the spirit of that movement, he absorbed mm-hmm. in a very, very real way.
And there's something similar about, you know, the, you know, Emerson starting his life as a minister and going on his own kind of journey, very spiritual, very interested in the metaphysical, but outside of any traditional church or religion, is there's something characteristic of the era, it seems.
There is, yes. Yeah. And of Nunn.
And of mm-hmm. Nunn. Yeah. So you know, starting with your experience as a Deep Springs student, you know, and then concluding with your, you know, and continuing with your ongoing leadership and you know, also writing this history, you've made a career in which you've become one of the foremost kind of theorists and observers of experiments in higher education in America. And that's one of the things we studied. It's an interesting part of the origin story of Thoreau College. when I was a student, one of Jack's students, we had a little class. It was maybe probably Deep Springs class, five or six students on experiments and maverick colleges. Two of the students in that class are now executive directors of new colleges or of experiments. So highly effective.
That is a testament to the effectiveness of Deep Springs, if there ever was one.
So, but I think one of the things I remember from your formulation there is that if we look at, you know, certainly the last 100 or 150 years in higher education in America, there are waves of foundings of new takes on higher education. Of which, you know, here being gathered at Nunnian Summit, we're clearly in the middle of another one. But I'm wondering if you can situate that history a little bit. Deep Springs is in the progressive era. It's there's other colleges founded around that time, and it's persisted all the way down to be over 100 years old now, and to be inspiring another wave at this moment.
Yeah, Nunn was so concerned that his ideas would not perish, and that Deep Springs would become a model that might be adopted elsewhere. And observing this through my awareness of the history over the last century of Deep Springs, outside of a few people like myself who entered higher education with this ideal and tried to bring it to life in the undergraduate programs at the University of Utah, for example, it never has really caught on. So what's inspiring to me, Jacob, is what you're doing and Bryden Sweeney Taylor and others in these new micro-colleges. That is, this might actually multiply. It might actually take root. And it makes sense because in many ways we're looking at the same social conditions and crises in America today that were present when Nunn was dreaming up and founding Deep Springs a century ago.
And what would those be?
Well, primarily we're looking at two things I guess I would mention among many, but we don't have forever. And one of those is the spiritual quality of life. And that is, today I think we're facing a situation in which there is a great hunger for spirituality in this broad sense that we referred to it a few moments ago, not religiosity, mm-hmm. but a feeling that we are connected with one another, that we are a part of the universe, that we are insignificant and humbled by that, at the same time inspired by the awe of the beauty around us, as you described the physical beauty of Deep Springs earlier. So I think the micro colleges that I'm seeing jump up now, like Thoreau, they all touch the spirit of a student.
Yeah,
they make you feel differently about yourself, your place in the universe, your connectedness, particularly with other humans and with ideas that make human life more pleasant, more bearable.
So some of the language that we've been using, you know, has to do with meaning-centered or you know, addressing a meaning crisis.
Yeah.
Which is, that certainly quickly comes up when you talk to students who apply or attend here or at Thoreau. They're like, what are you, you know, there's a connection, I guess, to the world and to each other, and that you could call a spiritual connection.
That's right, yes. And we all yearn for that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in our highly technological age and in the changing culture of the world and of our own country, material success becomes more and more the measure of the person. And what it seems to me people like you and I are fighting for, and that is that you can't educate somebody with facts. These facts have to be understood through the context of ideas. Liberty, justice, equality, mercy. And how do you learn those? Well, you have to live them.
Yeah.
And you live them by being in intense relationships with other people where the stakes are high, you've got a job to do, and you build that trust.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, it strikes me we are in another era of concern about democracy also.
That's the other point I was just going to bring up. Yes, exactly. Democracy is on the skids. Not just in America, but in many other places around the world. And we see these swings of the pendulum, but I think we're seeing a swing of the pendulum in an alarming direction further today than we have experienced in America before.
Mm-hmm.
We had McCarthyism in the 1950s. We've had the Know-Nothing movement over a century ago, but trust that people can get together and make decisions in their interest and in the interest of the world that they occupy is certainly down. And it's down in terms of the most prominent leaders. It's down in terms of the material emphasis, preoccupation that we see in the media.
Yeah.
But it's not down in individual people. We still yearn for this connectedness. We still yearn for this meaning that I am more than just an animal mechanism, that I can matter, that I can bring joy to other people around me, near and far, and relieve suffering in the same way.
Yeah. So, there's such a collapse of trust in institutions in our culture right now. And when I think about my experience at Deep Springs and also in high school, where we had, you know, similar like participatory governance practices, is that when people, you know, the era of media and information we have, you know, some of the warts and wrinkles of leaders and of institutions become evident in a way that maybe was different 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's disillusioning. Like, oh, those people are, you know, they're just corrupt. They're actually just, they're human.
Yeah.
Right. And I think I really value what I took out of my experience in the sense of seeing you and other teachers and leaders and, you know, colleagues work through complicated and messy situations in real time. And so what I took from that was a sense of, you know, leaders, certainly you can have corrupt and leaders who are, you know, have malicious intent. But in general, like, it's hard to be to run something, right?
Whether it's
a government or a business or a college, even a micro college, right? It's contingent, and what's important is transparency and the process, and a commitment to working it through with the people that you're with. And that's been a real touchstone, I would say, in my life. Even looking out at, you know, other institutions, like, well, maybe. Yeah, it's the call is not to withdraw, but to dig in.
Yes, yes. And I think people are yearning for that meaning, and they're yearning for a chance to dig in. They're yearning to matter.
Yeah. Well, Jack, I think that's a good place to end our conversation here. We're about an hour or so in, and it's been a long time ever since I started this podcast. You were at top of the list there of people I wanted to talk to. So I'm really delighted that we had the chance to do this with you in person in studio here in Viroqua. Thank you so much for coming all the way here. We'll be delivering the keynote address tomorrow as part of the Nennian Summit. And thank you for your leadership and for your scholarship.
Thank you, Jacob, and thank you for what you do.
Thank you.